everyone. John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. Our guest this week is Robbie Koenig. Robbie is a former ATP player, an excellent, absolutely first-rate commentator, analyst, and tennis mind. But also, he was one of the co-hosts of the Tennis for Africa event that Roger Federer hosted along with Rafa Nadal in Cape Town last weekend. You probably saw this event clogging up your social media happily before it was replaced by Parasite. But this was an event that raised more than $3 million for the Federer Foundation and was a tennis match played before the biggest crowd in history, more than 50,000 people. It looked from afar, from an ocean away, like a tremendous event. And instead of relying on that secondhand information, we'll go to someone who was right there in the stadium and, again, was one of the co-hosts. Robbie is South African, so has special insight. This is a great conversation, both about the Tennis for Africa event, but also tennis in South Africa, and we also have a talk about tennis analytics at the tail end. So a good conversation with one of the all-time good guys here from South Africa's Robbie. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm so fired up after what was quite an inspiring weekend for the people of South Africa, hey bud.
That's what I want to talk about. We saw YouTube clips, and it seemed to dominate my social media feed, but you were there. What'd you see?
You know, John, what made it so much fun was the top, you know, it wasn't a tennis spectacle like what we would see on a regular basis at tour events. The tennis was fun, but for me, the joy came in South Africans who have been pining to see Federer and even Nadal live. They got to see it on their home turf and in the most spectacular extravaganza. That's the best way of me describing it, because it wasn't just a standalone tennis event. There was a lot of stuff going on, and the amount of buzz it created amongst the people who were there, but also the people who weren't there, was what's given me the most joy, because I've been so privileged to watch these guys in a week in and week out, and you can't take it for granted. So to see the joy on these people's faces, and then they started to feel like they were contributing to the Roger Federer Foundation, which, of course, they were simply by being there. So it was, you know, they were doubly invested. Yes, I'm buying a ticket to this, but I know it's going to benefit something bigger than me. And that's what was so cool.
What was, you know, sometimes we see these numbers and they say 800,000 people attended the Australian Open. And you say, all right, I guess that's a lot. 51,000 people saw this. I mean, that is an NFL football stadium. I mean, that's Wembley. How in the world did 50,000 people watch a tennis match? I mean, that's twice the size. That's 2.5 times the size of Arthur Ashe Stadium. Well, explain the scale.
Yes. So, just so you understand, it was a purpose-built stadium for the 2010. Soccer World Cup. So it is a soccer stadium, and that wasn't even capacity because they had to block out a few seats because of the way the viewing was structured.
Okay.
And that, I mean, it's a spectacular stadium at the best of times. I think they had a semi-final of the World Cup there, so you can understand the kind of scale that you are working with. And John, just to give you an idea, my good friend J.L. De Jager and his business partner were involved on the South African side in helping put this thing on. They could have sold that 3.5 times over. They had 350,000 people online in a half an hour period looking to get tickets for that. And, of course, there were only 50,000 tickets. So that gives you an idea of the demand. So that was never a problem. And, you know, it's a big stadium, but the thing about it is that it's not a very vast stadium. So it's 450,000. It's pretty close. And whilst it's not a tennis stadium and a tennis atmosphere where you're right on top of the action, like some of the big ones we see tennis at, it was still a very good vantage point for everybody there. They would have got a real sense of what they were watching.
Can I ask about Roger Federer's appeal in South Africa? Is this Roger Federer a global figure, or do South Africans really connect Lynette Federer, his mother, the foundation, and South African lineage?
Totally, John. We are, South Africans are a passionate sporting nation. We are very much like, would be a good country to compare to, like the Aussies. You know, sport is such an integral part of our society, especially at high school. High school sport is bigger than college / university sport, as you guys would call it. So from a young age, indoctrinated with sport, you know, a lot of kids go to school because it's of the sport, not because of the academics. And that's the kind of society that a lot of us have grown up in on. And then you have the connection with Roger, Lynette being South African, and then, you know, a lot of people have known that for a long time. So there's without a doubt that connection. Then you throw into the mix everything that Federer brings to the table, what a good guy he is, the way he plays the game, and the fact that, you know, at the World Cup, he sent Sia Khaleesi a message to congratulate the boys on winning. You know, that resonates with South African people big time, hey? And, you know, that's one of the reasons he's so popular here.
I want to go back to that World Cup in a second, but tell me what your role was. I heard your voice. I was happy to I was happy to hear you on my YouTube clips. What was your role in the evening?
So I was involved in emceeing the event, basically co-hosting the event with the South African presenter. So that was great. It's very interesting how involved the Roger Federer Foundation is with everything. So they have a designated team that helps put the event together because they've done so many of these now. They connect with the South African team. They have a blueprint. They put that in place. So I was asked to co-MC the event as well as commentate, which was a lot of fun for me because I don't get to do that too often.
Right.
A little daunting in the beginning because I haven't done a lot of it. But, you know, I did a lot of prep for it, and it was great for me to take me out of my comfort zone. And the amount of confidence it gives you after you've done something like that is fantastic. So I would feel comfortable doing that again in any sort of environment, John. But it's very interesting the way they do it, how the foundation asks of you to ask specific questions, because at the end of the day, it is for Roger's Foundation, and they want to speak about that and get that message across. So that was nice, but also tricky for me because I'm not talking only about tennis. I'm having to talk and ask questions about a subject that is perhaps not as familiar to me. So that required a bit of studying on my behalf to make sure I got that all locked down. But it was so nice just to be behind the scenes and watching it all come together. I was in Cape Town a couple of days before. My son was one of the ball kids. In fact, he was the ball kid that ended up having a rally on the court. I don't know if you saw that.
I saw that. That was your boy.
He was your little boy on the other side of the court. So, I mean, pure luck. He just happened to be in that corner at that time. You know, if Rafa had been in the other corner, he wouldn't have got a shot. So there was a that great connection there. And just to get the vibe, being courtside for everything, the energy that was resonating inside the stadium when Federer walked out, when Rafa walked up. Let me tell you, the star of the show was, as well with those three, was Lynette Federer. John, when she walked out, I don't know if you saw the energy, it was unbelievable. Then the first question I asked her was in Afrikaans. And then, of course, you know, there's a big Afrikaans community in Cape Town. They went nuts again. So for me, feeling that energy from courtside was fantastic. So I can only imagine what that felt like for the players. And Roger mentioned as much. He said he was, you know, when he walked out on the court, he was struggling to do the first interview with my co-presenter because he was welling up inside with the joy that he had received from the fans.
I would stop here and point out, it seemed to me from afar that Rafa Nadal played his role to perfection as well. Would you agree with that?
The guy's such a legend. He got it to the nth degree.
He got it, exactly. He realized. Mm-hmm.
He understands that it's Roger's Foundation and that he wasn't the star of the show, but he was a very important supporting act. And it's definitely worth highlighting how many followers he has as well. He is massive in this country. They love him. The following is not as big as Federer's, but it's huge. And he just gets it, John. He just gets it.
That's I was saying, here are two rivals that are, you know, ranked 2 and 3 in the world, right? This isn't these aren't two retirees. I mean, these are still two guys in the throes of their rivalry. One of them has 20 majors. One of them has 19. They're both fighting for this greatest of all time designation. And to do this, not when they're 55 years old and retired and everything's chummy, but to do this at this stage in their careers, I thought was pretty remarkable on both sides. But, boy, it looked from afar like Rafa really, as you say, he just seemed to get the dynamic intuitively.
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to, Jason and I, Jason Goodall, who was commentating with me, we were trying to think of two players who have been, you know, at the peak of their powers, and not, as you say, not just any two players, two of the greatest the sport has ever seen, do something like that, and nothing sprung to mind. I couldn't think of anything. I don't know if, you know, in the States there's been athletes like that. I don't know what the rivalries were like and the friendships were like with some of the famous basketball players, you know, maybe Magic and Larry Bird. You know, I don't know if there's any comparisons there, but for me, nothing sprung to mind. So, you know, again, not only are they pioneers in the records that they're setting, but also off the court, which, I mean, it's just going to add to their legacy, isn't it?
No, absolutely. I mean, I've said this before. I think these guys realize that they are bracketed together for life, and they may as well embrace it. And they may as well, instead of creating distance and instead of making this tribal, they may as well lean into the rivalry because it's inevitable that we're going to think of them in a lot of ways yoked together. Let me ask you, you mentioned the World Cup. And I was, when South Africa won the World Cup, whatever that was, in October in Japan, that very quickly became a mechanism to talk about South Africa today and a prism to talk about race. I mean, take this wherever you want, but how did the event the other night fit into what South Africa is in 2020?
You know, sports has been one of the greatest unifying tools in South African history in the last 25 years. And once again, I think that's exactly what it was. Just like the World Cup was, it crosses racial barriers. You know, even if for a fleeting moment that everybody embraces the good. And I think that's exactly what we saw in the match in Africa, is that, again, you know, you've got these two amazing people that are coming together and almost them uniting the country and everybody just jumping on board and enjoying it for what it was. These are two foreign guys that have contributed much to good philanthropic work in South Africa to underprivileged kids of all races, but probably mostly black kids that have benefited from the amount of funds that Roger has plowed into this country. And I think, you know, probably the white people as well see it as more of a tennis match. I think maybe some of the black people see all the philanthropic work he does. So it's a whole melting pot of great stuff, getting to see Roger and Rafa, appreciating everything that they've done. And I think everything that they've done has touched the different people, the different racial groups in different ways. Mm-hmm. And once again, it was a celebration of just all things good in South Africa that has been brought about by this guy and another guy, and Rafael Nadal playing his part. And then, of course, you throw in the fact that Trevor Noah came back, and Trevor's a household name here, and he is, again, one of these guys who crosses racial barriers, because I'm not sure if you know his background, but...
Yeah, read the book.
You know, a white... Yeah, so, you know, he's a melting pot of religions and ethnic groups, is Trevor. So he was a perfect guy to be part of the doubles match.
Is it naive to think about this in terms of possibly sort of catalyzing tennis in South Africa? I mean, is this something that could spark interest and growth, or was this sort of a wonderful one-off weekend?
Sure, that's a tricky question. You know, I would only hope that it would spark growth, but you just never know. I mean, we'll only know the answer to that, I guess, in 2 or 3 years' time. But you know, a few of us were discussing their former players that were there, that when we first saw the likes of Yvon Lendl and Pat Cash and Johan Krieg come back to South Africa and play in Sun City when they had some great exhibition matches there that they used to do there, that inspired us just to see them live. And, I mean, if Roger and Rafa doesn't inspire you as a young person to take up tennis, if you're choosing between one sport and another, I'm not sure there's anything else that could. So I guess my answer to you is, if this doesn't beef up tennis in the country or certainly ignite some passion for it, I don't think anything will.
Did you spend much time with them off court? I mean, did you get a sense of sort of Roger's state of mind? Obviously, they were both coming off Australia. Did you get a sense of sort of where either of those two guys are in February?
No, not really. I didn't spend much time around them at all. They were involved in functions pretty much all day, every day. I did have a chat with Carlos Costa, and I said, you know, how you been enjoying it? And he goes, oof, these guys are working me hard, man. So I guess Rafa had lots of commitments and stuff that he was doing with Roger, and I didn't really discuss post-Australian Open or where they're feeling. You know, I don't know if you know, but Rafa also played an exhibition with David Frey in Kuwait, so he had some commitments there before coming down to South Africa. So it seems like it was a week where both guys had a lot on their plates, and the tour was really put to the side for the last 7 days.
I love Roger Federer's father with his phone out the whole time, capturing all this. I thought was I don't know if you saw that, but Robbie Federer was videotaping everything, and part of you wanted to say, I'm sure there are video crews there that would be happy to send you a link, but it would also be very endearing that this was like a father watching his, you know, kindergartner at a school play. Let me did you share my did you share the sentiment that I had a little bit of sympathy for Novak Djokovic, who wins his 17th major and edges closer and continues his great march, and he got a day or two of a victory tour, and then the whole tennis gaze was diverted to South Africa, and we quickly stopped talking about beating Dominic Thiem in five sets, and we were suddenly talking about a charity match. Did you share this?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel for Novak in that department, and also I just almost got the feeling that after winning in Australia, he couldn't appreciate the joy of winning, because it was almost like me against you. So when you won, rather than that unbelievable feeling of elation, it was more a feeling of, I told you so. I knew I'd win. To all you people out there in Rod Laver Arena, why did you doubt me? Why didn't you support me? So I feel for Novak that he should be enjoying these moments much more than what he is. And I think that's a little unfair, given what this guy's doing in this era. But as we've often said, you know, by 2008, people had joined sides already. You're either a Roger fan or a Rafa fan, and they have not enjoyed this guy coming in and being the party spoiler, whether, you know, they will make up any reasons they want to dislike him. But the fact of the matter is, what he has done in this generation is, you know, in itself is one of the greatest achievements, given the opposition he's had to face and beat.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, you just sort of do this as a math exercise. And look, the guy's won, what is it now, five of the last seven. He's the youngest of the three. He can play on any surface. I think a lot of people are like, hold on a second. This guy here, who's third now, may end up leapfrogging the other two by the time all this is said and done.
Too true. And again, it was a discussion we were having a lot of last week, because Rafa and Roger were in town. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fans of those respective players are now already changing their tune, because when it was all about Grand Slams, now they're saying, oh, it's all about who's the most loved. That's what's going to count. These two are much more loved than Novak. So they're already changing their tune almost in anticipation of perhaps Novak surpassing them, which is kind of funny because a couple of years ago it was only about majors, and whoever had the most majors, that was the only barometer to measure the greatest against. So, yeah, in some ways, I get a little tired talking about it let's wait for it to be done and dusted. But at the same time, I do get a lot of I'm intrigued by how the respective fan groups go at one another. I mean, on social media yesterday, I was in a rush just, you know, saying, I put out a tweet and I actually forgot to put in Rafael Nadal's name.
Oh, forget. I hope you're wearing a helmet.
Fantastic to have these people out here. And then the next thing, you know, I've got everybody saying I'm so disrespectful to Nadal. I'm on a plane. The contest is I'm on a plane just about to take off and I want you to put the pictures in. And now it's like, oh, I've got no respect towards Rafa. And it's like, come on, man. You know, this is what you're up against. This is what social media is like. And I can see how the respective fan groups, because they are so big and powerful, have created, I think, a lot of negativity towards Novak Djokovic, which I think is unfair.
Yeah, so someone made an interesting point to me. They said the other thing, too. All three of these fan groups are also wildly out of character with the three players they represent. I mean, you know, Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic are the three of the most sort of upstanding, mellow guys, respectful toward each other and everyone else. And the fan groups are so not representative of the three players. But someone made an interesting point to me. They said a criticism of Federer is seen as value-driven, and a criticism of Nadal is somehow, again, seen as value-driven, and a criticism of Djokovic or a feeling that he's omitted or not loved is seen almost as an ethnic slur. You're almost saying something about the Balkans. And I thought that was an interesting prism to think about this. You know, obviously, when we root for a player, it obviously goes a lot deeper. It says something about our values and what we prioritize and what we, you know, we're expressing ourselves. But someone made an interesting point that a lot of the Djokovic criticism in particular is sort of seen as almost an ethnic slur, which was something I did. I don't agree or disagree. It was just something interesting to think about.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what's interesting is what you said about the groups and how different they are to the players that they support. I've never thought of it, but I think that's spot on as well. But I guess that's social media in this day and age. But I want to understand you when you say value. What do you mean by that when you're saying you're following Roger and Rafa because of value?
Yeah, I think it's true for rooting in general, right? I mean, when we say I love Serena Williams, I don't think it's because, oh, she has beautiful technique on her forehand. I think it's what does she represent? Sometimes it can be what they wear. Sometimes it can be where the player is from, how they go about their business, what their social media profile is. I think it's true sort of in sports in general, but in most sports you sort of have this hometown. You know, these are my Warriors representing my territory. I think in tennis, a lot of times, when you say, I love Maria Sharapova, I don't think it's because she won five majors. I think it's because she represents something that you find appealing. Do you buy that? Do you buy that?
Absolutely spot on, because it's amazing. You know, some of my woman friend loves Djokovic because they think he's edgy, but often their personalities are edgy and more pushing the boundaries, whereas the ones who love Nadal are slightly more conservative and he's, you know, good looking with a bandana. So I can totally understand what you mean by that, and it is spot on. It's, you know, I think in the case of those three, the tennis results are almost a byproduct of what they represent.
Exactly. And then it almost becomes personal when there's any sort of, you know, any sort of criticism suddenly becomes something, a criticism of you and what you stand for. Let me ask you one more question, and then we'll do a segue here. You mentioned how suddenly love and affection is suddenly – do you have the expression in South Africa? I guess it would work for rugby. The goalposts are moving. You're changing the goalposts.
Of course.
All right. So I think you're absolutely right. You feel the goalposts changing in the in this GOAT debate, in this greatest of all time debate. you mentioned love. which of course cannot be quantified. There are no analytics for love, even though I would love to see some approximation of that. You and I had a fun, we talk about the bad of social media. You and I had a fun discussion on social media, and a lot of other people joined in, about where data currently sits in tennis right now. You can have analytics for love, but you can have tennis analytics for a lot of things. And we were talking, I think, a bit about, I think a lot of this pivot that Novak Djokovic seems to have taken perhaps a bit away from analytics and changing up his team a bit. And you had mentioned data only goes so far. Where do you see all of these quantifiables that we now have access to? Where do you see the intersection between tennis and data right now?
I think data is useful, but tennis is such a reactive and fluid sport that it's very difficult. And plus, you don't have intermatch coaching like you do in a lot of other sports. I know your sports in America love their data. Right. But you've got time to think about everything. You're getting instructions in baseball about what kind of pitching this guy likes. You've got time to think about it. You're not having to react to a shot all the time. You know, same in basketball. You've got the timeouts. You've got set plays that you can. You can't really have set plays in tennis except on the serve and the returner serve. And I think that's an area I highlighted. The one area of analytics I find interesting in tennis is players' tendencies on break points, because it's such an important point in the scoring system of a tennis match. And you have to remember, it's just a tendency. And there's nothing definitive about that. And the moment I think you try and sell it as a definitive and it doesn't happen, a player gets highly annoyed with everybody in his camp. And I think that's where you've got to be very careful with analytics and how you sell it to the player. And you speak to most players, that's what they will tell you. And even to, you know, as far as I had a good chat with Goran Ivanisevic about that.
Right,
and he mentioned that when it doesn't go the way the player expects it to go, it thumbs up at you as if to say, yeah, great stuff on the feedback there. That didn't work so well. And already it puts him in an angry frame of mind.
That's really interesting. It reminds me, it's like yelling at your broker. You know, I told you to put money in, in gold. It was a 55% chance. Well, that's really interesting. So you're saying sometimes when players are yelling at their, you know, we see this a lot and a lot more often. Sometimes we see players yelling at their box, at their team. You think sometimes that's because the data failed them? You said he went cross court when he hit a return on the run.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great story. He was telling me, I think it was Darren Cahill was telling a good story at the coaching conference recently in the States when he was helping out Andy Murray as one of the Adidas coaches. And, you know, he said to him, don't be scared to use the drop shot. And he played the drop shot early on in the match. It was like, you know, in the first game, and the guy got there and hit it for a clean winner. And he turned to him and he said, good job, coach. You're a great coach, man. Way to recommend the drop shot on that one, you know. So that's the beauty of tennis, is that you have to figure it out yourself depending on the situation. And you don't know. Yes, a player has tendencies, and the ability to guess those tendencies, that's a skill, but I believe that skill is often down to gut feel, how you feel in that very moment. You can have a connection with that guy on the other side of the court, and you have this feeling. I don't know if you've ever read Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, but
yeah,
he talks about
sure.
how important that gut feel is. And I think that is as important, if not more important, than just going on straight stats. What's happened in the 2 hours or 3 hours? You know, there's constant feedback that you're getting from the guy on the other side of the net. And I think that intuition is massive.
And that can never be built into an algorithm.
That's what I think, especially in a sport that is as fluid as tennis is. Different if you're playing a sport like golf, where, you know, everything is static. The ball is not moving. You've got complete control. And that's why I took about serves and returns as being the one area that's very interesting to me, because John Wertheim might have a favorite serve. And you know that because you've practiced 1,000 serves. And every time you serve down the middle of a juice side, you hit the can. But every time you serve out wide, you kind of miss the can.
Right.
And that's been something that's been part of your DNA for the last 10 years. So as a coach, I would be saying to you, look, you know, the stats prove in matches that when you go down the system, you generally hit your spot more often. You might not necessarily win the point, but I would say to you, John, in those big moments, go with the shot that has served you well. That's when I think it's important. But when you talk about guys hitting 2 shots cross-court, 1 down the line, and then he hits the 3rd one to the backhand and comes in, and right. I think you've got to be so careful. There's a lot of data out there. People are wanting to make money out of it, sell it, quantify it into monetary terms, and make something of it. And I understand that. There's a job for companies out there. But I think in tennis, you've got to be very careful, John.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're essentially saying the same thing, which is, mm-hmm. First of all, you have to make sure the data is clean. I mean, one of my issues with tennis data so often is that it just doesn't tell the story, and it's not statistically significant. Or like you say, there is so much context and there is so much situational going on. And it could be something as silly, you know, I have a blister, so I want to shorten the points. Or it could be a windy day against a left-hander. You know, there's so much. Or the guy on the other side of the net, I'm agitated because I played him 2 weeks ago. There is so much that goes on.
Points. Every single one of those are spot on.
But the flip side of that is I also feel someone was telling me about a player who I will remain nameless, named Stan Wawrinka, who apparently hits a passing shot one way on the run and another way from a standing position, and it would be really helpful to know that if I were on the other side of the net. You know, he goes cross court on the run and he goes down the line when he doesn't have to move as much, and it's very consistent. And if I were on the other side of the net, it would be crazy of me not to want that information.
No, and, you know, that's all good and well, but often under intense pressure in, you know, the biggest matches,
right.
It's not so easy to have that clarity of thought. Mm-hmm. When all you're worried about is making the approach shot to his backhand, or you're then worrying about, is he a bit more static or is he on the run? My tendency would be, if I was the guy on the other side of the court, to come in and take up a natural position. Would I be gambling to guess one side or another? I mean, I understand those tendencies, but
right. It's good.
It's a difficult one. And I think you know, there will be people. Again, also the player is important. What kind of player are you? If you're Milos Raonic, is known as somebody who likes a lot of analytics and a lot of feedback. Kevin Anderson is another one like that. They might be more comfortable with that. Other players are very much instinctual. Perhaps somebody, I don't know, like a Dan Evans, who plays with a lot of feel and just general good court craft.
Right.
You don't want to take away that from him.
No, it's a good point. I mean, I think a lot of it depends. You're right. Not just on the type of person the player is, but the type of player the player is. And at 4-all, do you want your head cluttered or do you want your head clean? And some players would say, give me any advantage I could possibly get and any incremental edge I'll take. And other players would tell you, I just want to go out there and do what I've always done and play tennis and get back to what brought me here. I don't want to be thinking about 56% chances versus 44% chances. It's an interesting discussion.
No, excellent point. Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I tell you what they do here with, I mean, obviously you have a lot more data points, but with baseball and basketball, they do what's called high leverage, where you have a different set of statistics, a different set of analytics for pressure situations. So your at-bat in the second inning of a baseball game is looked at differently as your at-bat when it's a tie game in the ninth inning. Or the jump shot you take when the score is tied with 4 seconds left in the game is categorized differently than the jump shot you take, you know, in the first few minutes of the game. Maybe tennis needs to refine and have something like that. Just tell me what happens at 4-all. I don't want to know what happens, 1,000 points a year in some 500-level event on a Tuesday night. Just tell me what my opponent does in the tight moments. Anyway.
Oh, no, true. And then also, no, you're spot on. It's a very important point, John. And it also depends who's on the other side of the net as well. So I've always said when I'm commentating, the only thing that matters in sport is how you deal with pressure, because everybody's great at one or two or three. But it's when the chips are down that we have seen players play completely differently to what they did in the opening six games of a set. Miss routine shots, serve double faults, miss basic returns, simply because the pressure is on. And I couldn't agree with you more. Those metrics that you measure by have to be much more heavily weighted in those situations than any other situation.
But all that said, I'm happy we're having this conversation, because five years ago it was break point converted, and that was the extent of data and tennis. So anyway, we've hit our mark. This was terrific, as always. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure talking.
Likewise, John. You've got so many good insights, and I think it's important that we discuss. It would be interesting to have a three- or four-way panel discussion with people who are very much involved in the analytics, because one of the questions I always ask is if I give you the game plan, okay, I know how to beat Rafa. This is how you got to do it. But the guy loses to him. So where does the analyst sit in that position? Because he knows what the game plan is. This is what you need to do. And my answer to that is, in tennis and in sport, everything is about execution. You can have the best game plans in the world. You can know all the metrics, but if you can't execute, a lot of it counts for naught.
Right.
So that's always one of my responses to the player. When your player loses, how much accountability do you have?
Everyone has a game plan until they get punched in the face. No, it's easy to sit there in the lounge. It's all you have to do is win 51% of the points, and you're going to win this match. And all you have to do here is patterns. And I mean, I've seen these discussions, and it sounds great when you're sitting there in the lounge, or when you're watching tape, or when you're telling me that the third shot of every rally, Nadal, if you have him behind the baseline, he's going to go cross court. When you're actually out there and have to execute, I think you're right. It doesn't become theoretical anymore. All right, this is great. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for your this was really helpful. I mean, I think we all followed this match for Africa with a smile, and the video was great, and the team there did a great job with social media. It was very fun to sort of get the updates. But you were there, you were calling the match, you were in the stadium. So I think your insight, as always, is excellent and appreciated. So thanks.
Thanks, John. Always a pleasure to chat to you and be on your show. Thanks, mate.
All right. We'll catch up soon. Take care. All right. Thanks for Robbie for spending some time with us. We talked to him, I think it was after Wimbledon, and had a lot of nice feedback how we should have him on more often, and we aim to please. And he is generous enough to accommodate. Robbie's one of the good guys out there, one of my running buddies out on the tennis caravan. So thanks to Robbie. And Jamie, you are producing that podcast as ever. Thoughts? Did you watch the did you see much of the tennis for Africa match?
I think you're right. It did come across on the feeds. There was a lot of course, Bill Gates, Trevor Noah, as Robbie talked about. So lots of people from the U.S. there, big names. I think the whole dynamic that you guys talked about between Roger and Rafa is so interesting. And to your point, how they, I think, have sort of accepted this, whether they're going to be pit against each other or just put in the same paragraph, that they just kind of have to embrace that. And so it was really cool to see them two doing stuff together, having a good time. It's always nice to see the lighthearted side that we sometimes see at the team competitions or things like that.
Reminds me a lot of Bernie supporters and Trump supporters. They just come together for the greater good, and they put down differences, and they realize that they may be locked in a rivalry, but at the end of the day, we're all people. I do think part of what makes this whole thing so remarkable is just it's so inconsistent with the times, where everything, sports included, has become so tribal. But that seemed like a terrific event. And good to see Roger Federer, emotional as always. I don't know if you saw. It seemed like when his mom hugged Rafa Nadal, strangely enough, that seemed to trigger this emotional wellspring as much as everything else. And just the spectacle of it all. I mean, again, I think the scale of this. I mean, I went to a Davis Cup tie once in Spain in Seville. It was actually when I think Nadal was still a teenager. The U.S. against Spain, and it was played in a soccer stadium, and it was, I think it was the biggest crowd ever to watch a tennis match at the time. It was half the size of this, so I can't imagine. Part of it's just watching a little ball in a soccer stadium. But I can't imagine how that played out. I mean, big screens only get you so far. 51,000 people in one venue to watch tennis is an interesting proposition, but I suppose that tells you something about Roger Federer's popularity.
Yeah, I mean, exhibitions in general are so interesting. We know that the players don't take them half as seriously as any major. Oh, sorry.
No, I'm kidding.
Big secret.
Yeah, right.
But to your point, people fill up stadiums to come see them, probably stand there or interact with each other just as much as they want to see them hit the ball across the net. So it just, again, speaks to their star power and just how much of an impact they have on the sport and just on a global stage in general. I think that's the other interesting thing is how there's not too many players in other American sports that have such a global reach as tennis players do. And that's always so interesting to me in comparing all the different sports is how much people like Federer and Nadal have such a global worldwide impact on so many different people.
And other sports would kill for that. I mean, the NFL is still scratching their heads. I mean, the NBA is way ahead of other sports.
Right. But not nearly as much.
But right.
I mean, they've only sort of conquered a small area, and that's only a handful of players. So it's very interesting.
I think, I think tennis has a real edge. We sometimes forget this. I mean, the other sports are still trying to figure out how to globalize. And tennis is way ahead of the game. All right, we have another guest coming in. February, strange month for the sport. And I do think we need to, can we pause for 15 seconds and give Novak Djokovic some love? I mean, I don't know if you caught that when I was telling Robbie. I did feel this pang of, and somehow this maybe echoes a broader theme, but here Novak Djokovic wins a match that counts and wins his 17th major, and it's on a Sunday, and it's Super Bowl Sunday, and it sort of gets swept up. I mean, this is a busy week in the United States. We had an impeachment. We had a State of the Union address. We had the Iowa caucus.
Right.
A lot happened. And then the tennis news was immediately in Cape Town, South Africa. And I'm sure Djokovic is thinking, wait a second. I just want a match that actually counts and won my 17th major. And I'm within three of Federer, which I've never been before. Where's my parade? So Novak Djokovic, let's give you some due. That's I've said my piece. All right, that does it for this week. Thanks, Jamie, as always.
Thank you.
Thanks to Robbie for spending some time with us, and we will have another podcast next week. If you want to leave a review or subscribe, please do so. It always helps. We are at Stitcher, Amazon, wherever finer podcasts are sold. Leave a review and keep the guest suggestions coming. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll do it again in 7 days.